Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
You're listening to episode 252 of TV's Top 5, The Hollywood Reporter's TV Podcast. I'm Leslie Goldberg, the West Coast TV editor, and I'm joined as always by the great Dan Feinberg, The Hollywood Reporter's chief TV critic. How's it going, Chief?
It's okay. Busy. Ramadan Mubarak to those who observe, our Muslim listeners. I assume we have a handful, so a well and fulfilling fasting period for those who do. Also, not nearly as holy, but happy March Madness to those who observe that. And of course, happy opening week of baseball season, or kind of mixed happy week of the baseball season to those who observe that, namely Leslie.
Yeah. Thank you for everyone for your understanding, as I had some personal stuff going on last week and wasn't able to do a podcast. It was very loud here with a lot of construction, among other things going on because of storm damage. But anyway, I digress. And speaking about baseball, yes, I know about Shohei Ohtani's former interpreter, or now former interpreter, and I have a lot of questions and thoughts, but that's for another time. And definitely,
I was going to say, I don't feel like you do know. That's the thing.
I don't know anything. All I know is that I have way more questions than I have answers, like every other Dodger fan and baseball fan. So,
absolutely true, but.
Yeah, well, rather than talking more about my beloved passion for baseball, we're going to get right into it. We've got a lot of headlines to get to and a terrific interview with the one and only Danai Gurira of The Walking Dead, plus a supersized Critics Corner. So this week is going to be a full episode, but it's only three topics. But don't worry, it'll still be just as long. Leading off with headlines.
Number one.
Starting off with some breaking news, Pete Davidson has walked away from Bupkis. There will be no second season of the SNL grad's semi-autobiographical Peacock comedy, despite the previous renewal. As Davidson said in a statement that, quote, this part of my life is finished. So pour one out for Bupkis and anyone who worked on that show. And in other shows not getting a second season, Showtime has ditched plans for a sophomore run of Darren Star's former Netflix comedy Uncoupled, starring Neil Patrick Harris. Yes, it aired on Netflix for one season. They canceled it. Chris McCarthy stepped in to pick it up because, well, he's a gay executive and he wanted to continue Showtime's legacy of telling stories that support the LGBTQ community. And now it's not actually going to happen after all. So Uncoupled, canceled, not once, but twice.
I'm going to be honest. I'm not sure I remembered what that Neil Patrick Harris show actually was. So I'm not going to get upset with that. I'll get a little bit upset about Bupkis. On the other hand, though, there would be no more Bupkis a plot line than a Bupkis plot line about Pete Davidson deciding he didn't want to do a second season of Bupkis, but that was really just a ruse while he was doing the second season of Bupkis. So maybe it's going to be a whole big old surprise or something. I don't know. A little disappointed on that one, simply because as I've said several different times, once you get away from the first episode of Bupkis, I think it was a really good and often charming and perceptive TV show. And it's too bad if Pete Davidson has, it feels as if he's moved away from the chapter of his life in which he makes perceptive and introspective television shows. So, you know, not going to be crushed by it, but still disappointed.
Just go watch The King of Staten Island. That was excellent.
I liked The King of Staten Island. And again, that's why I feel like whatever the period of his career is that he thinks that he's moving out of, the period of his career that he's moving out of had some pretty good things in it. So I don't know necessarily why he would want to move away from it too much, but whatever. Pete Davidson can do whatever he wants, and I'm fairly confident that I have no ability to get Pete Davidson to do anything that I want him to do. So anyway, continuing along. In casting news, Nicole Kidman will return for the second season of Hulu's Nine Perfect Strangers, previously described as a limited series for award purposes, so yay! She will be joined by new series regulars Henry Golding, Mark Strong, and Lena Olin. In addition, on the casting front, this from, well, an ongoing series that's now an anthology series, David Schwimmer will star in the second season of Disney Plus's Goosebumps, an anthology.
On the new series order front, Apple is hoping that Owen Wilson and golf can do for it what Jason Sudeikis and soccer did with Ted Lasso, as Wilson will star as a former golf pro in a TV series, a scripted TV series for the streamer. Elsewhere, Jason Bateman and Jude Law will play brothers in the Netflix limited series Black Rabbit. And the streaming giant has also picked up a drama called Untamed, an original thriller starring Eric Bana from Warner Brothers Television. That same studio is teaming with former Grey's Anatomy showrunner Krista Vernoff to adapt Glennon Doyle's best-selling book, Untamed, with Sarah Paulson set to star in the series that also counts J.J. Abrams as an executive producer. So for those keeping score at home, that's two shows, both titled Untamed, both produced by the same studio, and one of them based on a book and the other an original idea. So yeah, there's going to be some title stuff going on there.
At least it feels as if it's pretty obvious which one of those two shows has to blink. And it's the one that's not based on the best-selling book of the same title. So if I were Eric Bana, I would be, you know, just spitballing alternative titles for his show on a hypothetical level. Yeah, that's silly, but
yeah, pretty wild that it's both at the same studio, which is nuts to me. So
continuing along, ABC has gone straight to series on Untamed. Wait, no. There are more than one name for television shows this week. Sorry. ABC
Cooler Town.
Yes. ABC has gone straight to series on Dr. Odyssey, a medical drama starring Joshua Jackson from Ryan Murphy, as the prolific producer continues to create new series as part of his return home to Disney. Dr. Odyssey. Sounds badass. I'm there. Dr. Odyssey this fall on ABC.
Followed by 911, also from Ryan Murphy.
Sure, why not? It, you know, keeps the people excited. ABC has also ordered its second pilot of the season. Have we mentioned lately that that pilot season used to be dozens upon dozens upon dozens of shows, and here we are, it's like ABC, a second show. Why not? I think we have mentioned that, incidentally.
Yeah. I mean, more than 10 years ago, it was over 100 pilots at the five broadcast networks.
Yeah, well, ABC's second pilot of the season is Forgive and Forget, a multi-camera father-son comedy starring Modern Family Emmy winner Ty Burrell.
Congratulations to Ty Burrell. I look forward to having him back on my screens. Elsewhere on broadcast, NBC has renewed five of its six Dick Wolf shows, with Chicago Med, Fire, and PD all returning alongside the Law & Order flagship series and SVU. Only Law & Order Organized Crime is awaiting word on its future of Wolf's stable of NBC shows. Elsewhere at CBS, Ghosts, Fire Country, and NCIS Sydney will all return for the 2024-25 season. And not quite a renewal, but still kind of a renewal. FX will film seasons 3 and 4 of the Emmy-winning comedy drama comedy The Bear back-to-back, despite not officially announcing a fourth season renewal for the show. So I mean, smart, considering that cast is in increasingly high demand, and yeah, keeps that show on at least an annual basis for the next, hopefully, 2 years.
Yeah, not particularly shocking, and also not particularly shocking that they would want to cap the window that they have Jeremy Allen White and Io Deborah so that they can do other things and FX can still have The Bear. So, not surprising. On the unscripted side of things, Netflix is continuing to bet big on sports and sports-adjacent programming. Streamer has ordered Receiver, which will follow a group of NFL wide receivers plus one tight end for the upcoming season. They previously did a season where they covered quarterbacks. So just keep waiting and eventually you'll get your season entirely dedicated to
punters.
Well,
no one wants that.
I was gonna go with defensive tackles, but you know, yes. Punters. Finally, an entire season of punters coming this way. Except for the problem is that British people would hear punters and they would assume that it's about something different. So anyway, whatever. In unscripted series news, which is what we were just doing, Jimmy Kimmel will executive produce High Hopes, a reality series set in a Los Angeles pot shop for Hulu. And Amazon has also confirmed that it is teaming with YouTube superstar Mr. Beast, not to be confused with Dr. Odyssey, for but they should. In fact, that's the name of my new crossover YouTube personality. Dr. Odyssey and Mr. Beast. Oh, God, that sounds great. It's a little bit like Strange and Norell for the 21st century, which is a reality competition featuring 1,000 contestants vying for $5 million in cash. Amazon beat Netflix for the right to the series. And everyone is sort of bending over backwards to either say why this is the biggest competition reality program ever or why it's actually not in any way that. So I've heard... Yeah.
What I've heard is that Amazon has spent more on this show than any other unscripted show in history. So meaning they paid a lot more to get it because obviously there were other bidders here vying for Mr. Beast and his services. But Amazon, I'm told, relinquished complete creative control of the show in exchange for landing it. So yeah, $5 million is a lot of money, but I imagine they paid a significantly more than that. I've heard it might have been between $80 million and $100 million just to get the rights to the show.
The kids do love them some Mr. Beast, apparently. So
yeah, but I'm honestly more than that. I'm really excited about High Hopes, but I do find it a little funny that it's for a Disney-based platform, and you know how concerned Disney is with what content it has, and it's actually going to do a TV MA show about weed dispensaries. So sign me up.
I mean, it doesn't need to be TVMA. It could be a loving family type show about
It is TVMA.
Oh, okay. They've actually announced that. Okay. So, well.
No, they didn't announce it. I hear sources say that it's TVMA.
Okay. I mean, sure. Why not? But weed is for the children now. It's a whole different era, Leslie. So yeah, I don't know. We'll see what it actually looks or feels like.
And you know how much I love talking about the saga of Snowpiercer. Well, the former TNT drama has found a new home. AMC will air the previously produced fourth and final season of the former TNT drama. This show has had such a wild ride, right? It was going to be for TNT, then it was for TBS, but they changed showrunners, then they changed directors. Then it was just, this thing has been bounced around, shaken, stirred, thrown away, recovered. It's such like a poster child for, right up there with like One Day at a Time for the TV shows in the peak TV era, you know, because this one's nuts. So somewhere on THR.com, there's a great TikTok for me of all the different incarnations of this show and all the different speed bumps it hit along the tracks to getting on the air. And I kind of want to update it, but I kind of don't because that's extra work and I don't like doing extra work. But anyway, Aaron cut the part where I say I don't like doing extra work, but honestly, it's the ride that this show has had is a wild one, to say the least.
Once upon a time, we did an interview with, I think it was Graham Manson, who was the showrunner at the time when we did the interview. And
the
he
second
was
showrunner, yeah.
Yeah. Was he the second or the third showrunner? I'm not even sure. Oh, I feel like there were several before him and there have been several since him. So
yeah.
I don't know. Do you want to tell the kids where they can find that interview?
No.
Okay. You do not want to, because you don't want to do extra work.
No, don't. I didn't say that. Hang on. I'll find it. Snowpiercer. You can find our interview with Graham Manson pegged to Snowpiercer. That would be episode 70 from May 15th, 2020. Episode 70. It sounds like so many lifetimes ago.
It was yet another one of those press tour in a room interviews. So in a room in person. Ah, good times. Anyway, continuing to speak about final seasons, because that was what we were talking about Snowpiercer, other than when we were talking about a new network and new showrunners and all of that stuff. Starz has announced that its first Power spinoff, Ghost, will conclude with its upcoming fourth season.
Yeah. Ghost. And they continue to work on other spinoffs of this franchise, even after former showrunner Courtney Kemp departed Lionsgate, producers Lionsgate, for a Netflix overall deal. So Power franchise is going to look a little different in the years to come at Starz as they are kind of phasing out the first wave and preparing for the next chapter. So again, well, franchises and franchises.
Let me just say, though, if they are thinking of a good name for a Power spinoff, might I suggest Untamed? Untamed.
I love what you did there, Dan. A weird episode, and we've got so many topics that we just went through in headlines. We're going to go straight to our showrunner spotlight segment.
Number two.
Our guest this week is a Tony-nominated playwright who has returned to the role that helped make her a household name in AMC's The Walking Dead. Danai Gurira is best known as the katana-wielding Michonne. She wrote and served as showrunner on the fourth episode of the spinoff, The Ones Who Live, and is also a co-creator of the series alongside fellow star Andrew Lincoln and AMC's Walking Dead content chief, Scott Gimple. Thanks so much for joining us, Danai.
Thanks for having me.
So let's go back to before the pandemic. Can you walk us through your decision to leave The Walking Dead after season 10 and what made the timing then right?
It's funny, they say seven is the number of completion. I had done seven seasons, and it's 8 months of a year that you're giving to this thing. And I loved that. I loved the commitment. I loved the amount of time and energy it took. That's what attracted me to the show. It just felt like everything was being poured into it by the people I watched, because I came in season three. So I was watching others as I was thinking about auditioning. And so I was looking at the Bernthals and at Andy and, you know, at Steven and Norman and everybody and Melissa. It was just such an incredible effort I could tell they were making. And I really was attracted to that. And so it did take everything. I like that. I like giving my all, and it did take my all, but it just felt like the time was right to open myself up to other things and to explore other things and open up literally a different type of time in my life. You know what I mean? It's just, it's a commitment that's like, you kind of don't really have a home. You're in this place for 7-8 months of the year. And yeah, it just felt like the right moment. And so at seven, we're at seven, and then I did the half year, and it was time. It was just time. But I never let go of Michonne. I never let go of Michonne. It was always planned that Michonne, that I'd come back and complete Michonne.
Well, to what degree did it kind of feel like a closing of a chapter versus, as you say, just kind of a pause while you did other things and recharged, I guess, your energy or your enthusiasm or whatever it was?
Yeah, it was very clear that I was not done with her. And Andy had already, he'd already done that when he left. He was not done with Rick. And so it was clear he was coming back. And that, I think that was announced pretty quickly, I believe, that he was coming back with the movies. And it was always planned that I would do that with him, though we didn't announce that as much. But that was always the strategy he had before he left. And so when I did start negotiating out of the show, that was a part of it, was that I would come back and do that. And so the way it was structured, how I left, leaving, finding clues that he wasn't dead, a lot of that was also Gimple, because he was planning so much with the CRM and he'd been planting the CRM all over the place. So that was a way to have her set out on her trek and on her journey. So yeah, that was always in the plans to do it this way. But we just didn't know when and how. It took a different form than we'd planned, but the plans to continue the story were always there.
Since you brought that up, I wanted to ask about that pivot. You know, obviously these, you know, The Ones Who Live was originally designed to be three feature-length films that mm-hmm. Universal had signed on to distribute theatrically. Mm-hmm. Can you talk to us a little bit about what shifted there? Like, what prompted the change? Was this something that came about through the writing and in discussions that you had with Scott and Andy? Because both you and Andy are credited, along with Gimple, as co-creators of the show.
Yeah, I mean, some of that I don't even know many details about. I know that AMC designed AMC Plus during the 3 years. The pandemic came along, things slow, things get shifted, you know, as we know it happens during the pandemic. So some of that I wasn't entirely privy to, but it was definitely about AMC Plus coming into play and then a new form being decided on. And then Andy and I were approached about co-creating with Gimple a miniseries or limited or a series of our choosing. So then we navigated on that journey. I think that was like 2021 we started that.
Have there been conversations piecemeal over those years, just like casual conversations with Andy, casual conversations with Scott? Or was it the kind of thing where you knew you'd come back together when the time was right, but you weren't constantly champing at the bit to do it?
Yeah, it was more the latter. We did converse. I mean, Gimple's like my brother. I have no idea how that happened, but we're like siblings. So I'm always in touch with Gimple. and, you know, Andy's family. So we were, you know, we were in touch just in general. And so we were aware of the stories, you know, we were hoping to tell, but we didn't formally come together to craft something until 2021.
How much of what was supposed to be in the three movies became part of The Ones Who Live? Or is the show completely its own animal?
Well, that's kind of more a Gimple question, I would think, because he was encyclopediaing the CRM, especially, you know, and the idea that, of course, is the major obstacle, really, between Rick and Michonne is really he'd been building up this world through other spinoffs and all sorts of things. So he was really crafting that and building that. And him and Andy had some conversations about things, but it really did shift into what TV format needs it to shift to. And then it was very much, there were some things I needed to catch up on them, the whole CRM ideology, which Gimple had crafted with great care, and then look into, okay, now how do we turn this into this two-hander show with, of course, a fantastic cast around us and an incredible crew. So that was kind of the journey there.
Having the three of you guys as co-creators, how did that actually work? Were there conversations where you were sitting and spitballing ideas? Were ideas passed around and you guys were sort of topping each other like on an email or text thread? What was the creative aspect of three people coming together to bring a unified vision to the show?
Yeah, it was really interesting because I don't know, we just decided we would meet whenever we could. And so we did. We would literally, somehow Andy would be in the country at times. We got together in New York a couple times. We got together in Atlanta. It was just like we would get together in like hotel conference rooms and we would hash this thing out. And we did have a very unified idea about what needed to be and what should be and what we should find and what we should make sure happens. And really coming around the idea, which initially was Andy's, was like, this is the love story. Like, there's nothing left to tell here. We have to tell the love story of these two. And so that's what he said long ago, like before we started. And then when we got in the room, it was really about the nitty gritty of turning a Walking Dead sort of idea, like being that this is a Walking Dead show, into an epic love story. And that was something that was, it was fun to do. I think probably I was more the expert on love stories between the three of us. So that was, it was an interesting navigation of how to, you know, make sure that that was the propelling and driving force. And so, yeah, it was really, there wasn't really any, I mean, really, it was actually interestingly not a difficult journey to take in terms of being the three of us. I know it's like three of you, but we were so on the same page about what needed to happen with this narrative and what needed to be seen and heard. I think the key thing was I was off doing Richard III and then I came back and they were in the writing room and stuff. And I came back and I was like, okay, what I'm hearing you guys say is we got to focus more here or focus more, you know, but that was after we'd already crafted the show and we were just going to some nitty gritty stuff. And I would just go in and give my little love story lecture and then keep it on the love story track. And that was kind of my thing.
We'll talk a little bit more about that. You know, what were the aspects of the love story that you felt were important to get out there just in a general love story principle, but more specifically in the love story between these two very specific characters and the journey that they've been through?
Well, you know, it's interesting because on the mothership did not really, or flagship, whatever you call it, did not really allow for the time and the space for a two-hander much. You know what I mean? There was a lot going on, as you know. A lot of people, a lot of different new antagonists, you know. So it was really like we have to make sure we don't fall into a default where we're caught up in the antagonism and the, you know, all that stuff. It's like, how do we make sure that we actually cut above what we've done in the past and make it like the driving energy is their love and what journey it takes. So it was very much about making sure, for me, I've watched love stories. I don't watch a lot of them because I feel like, honestly, I feel like most of them fail because I feel like they don't get to where you believe it and where all the threads come together satisfyingly. And so it was very important to me that we don't make that mistake, that we make sure that the threads are coming together, that there's a love story payoff at the core. And I think that's why this episode is very important to me to take charge of, because this is really where the love story payoff really cinches. The obstacles are clear, but when does the love prevail and conquer all? And so that's why it was very important to me to do this, to write this episode myself. Control freak much, perchance.
Given, the creative control that both you and Andy have here, overall, this is only a 6-episode season, but how much say did you both have about where Rick and Michonne's love story eventually ends? Is episode 6 a series finale or a season finale? Meaning, can this show live on for another season? Or is this really the end of Rick and Michonne's love story?
Well, you know I can't answer that, Leslie.
I had to try.
Good try, though. But yeah, we did have a good say, a lot of a say. We had the full say, actually. I mean, really, AMC was very much, they very much handed us the reins. They had thoughts and we discussed, but we had the reins. So what you ultimately see, other than maybe, of course, we always want a bigger budget, but ultimately what you see, time, money. Other than time, money, it is our vision, which always gets in the way with everything. But yeah, it's very much where the 6 episodes land, what arc they're in. Yeah, that's all me, Andy, and Gimple.
So let's talk a bit about the 4th episode. The season has a very particular structure. It's Rick's story, it's Michonne's story, then we get them back together, and then the 4th episode is kind of the thing everyone is waiting for. It's the, here they're putting all their cards on the table. Nah. When did it become clear what the episode's form should be, and then when did you say, I have to write this?
Oh, that was all in a hotel conference room in New York. We arced through the episodes and we knew that this had to be the bottle episode where these two really have the obstacles around them, the army, all that jazz, fell away. And these two grappled with their love in their crisis and they came out how they came out. So that was always the plan, that this was the bottle episode. It also helps budgeting, actually. But that was always the plan. And then for me, I then said, that's when I want to write. And then when we're getting closer to it, I'm thinking, oh my God, I got to get in shape. I got to do this, that, and the third. And I'm like, that's okay if I don't. They're like, no, you have to write it because no one else can write, has time to write it right now. So then it became a fact that I was writing it. But I did say, this is the one I want to write. Because, I guess it's my inclination as a playwright, just like wanting the idea of a two-hander. You have to keep the ball in the air and really justify that in a way that doesn't involve action and extra walkers and, all these things are in there, but this had to be something that was about the conflict between these two and their love and whether or not it will prevail. And it was so much that built up that they needed to get on the same page or not. And that kind of really appealed to me because I was like, that's the thing I don't think we get to do much on this show that, of course, I've yearned to see more of on the mothership, but we just didn't have there was just not the space for it. So it was definitely something that I was attracted to doing.
Scott has said that you effectively served as showrunner on episode 4. For you, what was this whole process like, given how much is in this episode? Look, it is a two-hander, but you've got monologues. There's so much emotional weight. There's action scenes. And then there's a love scene on top of it, too. There's so much going on, despite it being this bottle episode. But how did you navigate all of that in all the different emotional and physical places that you had to go to?
That's funny because, Andy was saying he was like being very kind. And he was just saying how he was amazed by my capacity because I was doing all of that. And he kept asking me, like, when I was writing it and shooting at the same time, shooting an earlier episode at the same time, he was like, when are you going to have the time to keep doing? And at the end of the day, I said, listen, at the end of the day, this is my baby. Like, you just take care of your kid. It's your kid. You know what I mean? You don't think about, oh, how am I going to? You just take care of your kid. At the end of the day, that this episode was my kid. So yeah, I had a wonderful director as well. And it was interesting because when I wrote the episode and it had all the monologues in it and all that, and Michael Slovis is incredible. I remember sitting down with him and our wonderful AD for that episode, Sarah, and I remember just sitting down with him and just being like, I really had to walk people through this episode. I guess it was a very unusual episode for everybody. You have tone meetings and you do all that stuff. And yeah, Gimple did say so I was the showrunner. Walking everyone through the vision was great. People really got it, but I guess it was very different for people to see how this episode was structured. And so it was something I really had to guide the vision of. It was funny what you're asking because I was like thinking about this one scene where it's a very emotional scene. It's like where Michonne and Rick run from the explosion and now they're in this sort of gym and everything's sort of buckling and there's a corpse there and they go into this fight and that's where it kind of gets really kind of gnarly between them. And I walked in there and I saw the actress. I had thought we were going to just use, because Walking Dead, we use a lot of dummies and stuff. So I was like, oh, we hired an actress. She's an actress. Oh my gosh. So we were getting to know her a little bit. But then I was like, I'm sorry. She just doesn't look dead enough. She's got about 3 weeks dead. She looks 2 days dead. So like I'm trying to like really work on this scene, which was an intense scene to make work right. And at the same time, I'm calling special effects makeup to make this lovely actress look 2 weeks more dead. So it was a couple of balls in the air at the same time, but you just want to take care of it. So you just, I don't know, I guess I just found what I needed to find to get it done. I don't know what more to explain about it, but there was a lot going on at the same time, absolutely. And overlapping with episodes, shooting one episode while you're writing this episode, and things change in one episode. So you have to shift what they're saying in the next episode because we took all the dialogue out of scene in episode 3. So now I needed to make sure it worked for 4 because there are things they have to say, you know, that we have to make sure they get out. So then they shift into 4. So now I have to do a rewrite. So yeah, there was a lot going on. But just because I was passionate about telling the story, I found the capacity to get it done. We did get a few days off after shooting this episode, so I got to recoup a little bit.
Well, I'm curious, when you're writing a play, what is your process involving how isolated you have to make yourself, how alone you have to be in order to do that generally?
I don't have to be alone. Sometimes I work best in noisy environments, oddly. So I really don't have to be that isolated. And, you know, it was, there wasn't really a, you know, there was like, you go home at night. So I had those times alone when I did need to really just buckle in. But there are times where I could be writing wherever on set, in my trailer, wherever, because I don't know, I guess it's because I've lived on sets and in theaters so long that I kind of know how to process commotion around me and still focus. Is, I don't know, maybe I'd be much better at everything I do if I focused more in a quiet environment. So I don't know. I'm okay at juggling, you know, the noise around me. But as a playwright, I would work sometimes in very noisy coffee shops, things like that. And even now I write in noisy areas. So it actually kind of works for how I had to juggle where I was. I couldn't always define where I could be to write this episode. So I had to go back to being good with noise around me and all that. But yeah, there's never a definitive place. Like I can think up something and want to write when I'm like waking up in the morning and just start writing when I'm still sitting in bed. Like I wish I had that beautiful mahogany oak or whatever table, and you know, with all the books behind me and, you know, the thing of cognac. And yeah, I just don't have like a specific like spot. I'm all over the place.
You know, television is such a specifically collaborative thing, and there was obviously a writer's room at some point. Was there a part in the process of writing this episode where you had to experience the process of sharing what you were writing in a different way than you would if you were doing, even in a crowded coffee shop, a play that was your play?
Yes and no. So with the writer's room, I was acting in Richard III. So I did not encounter the writer's room at all. And it was sort of ended in like August. And then we only started to write the episodes really in like November, December. So I never really encountered the writer's room. And so when I was writing 4 in the beginning, especially, I was completely alone. And then I started to share it with Gimple. And it was mainly Gimple, Denise, and Andy. Those are the 3 that I shared it with overall, and then ultimately to the network. And yeah, so it was really those 3 that I had conversations with, who I have conversations with about everything. And I think the journey was I had to knock this thing really far in terms of where they go emotionally from what we're used to. I had to let that, but at the same time, allow them to be themselves. So it was really finding that balance of like, how far out of themselves are they going to go in this episode? And then how much do we allow them to remain the Rick and Michonne we know? And so that was definitely the journey. And everyone, you know, people would have thoughts, you know, Gimple's going to hate me for saying this, but he hated the Roomba. He hated all that. And I fought for my Roomba. But, you know, there's always thoughts. But, you know, the beauty is like, we're artists and we all love each other and respect each other. If I could justify my thesis, they'd be like, okay, I get it. You know what I mean? Like, you have to share your vision in a way that people can get on board. And thankfully, that was not hard to do in terms of most of it. But, you know, it was like the idea therein of letting Rick go through, like, we have to understand Rick's behavior, and it cannot be a logical understanding. It has to be emotional. It has to be that sort of expected surprise. It has to be the thing that he's not going to say until there's a lot of walls broken down, you know? And so that's the journey he has to take. And so I had to study a lot. I had to research a lot about PTSD because that's what he's going through. He has gone through a captivity, like a man like Rick, who's like a leader and was always in the front lines of every battle, and now he can't even get to his family for that amount of time. It's a lot of trauma. And so really the journey of understanding that, because we're seeing him and we're seeing him sort of navigate things, but what's really underneath, where's the real wound? And of course, this was the episode. But Michonne has to be, she was naive because she doesn't understand why he's not just being himself, you know? And so that's a naive approach that she initially took. She should have realized, or she could have, or maybe realized, of course he's going to be coming out of trauma, you know, and how do I navigate that? So she has to get to the point, which the love scene is about. She has to get to the point of understanding like what it's going to take to help him, because she's not using the right tools to help him initially. And at the end, really the love scene, the love scene has its own story to it, but I was very keen on creating a love scene that was not the love scene we've seen a trillion times. And it had to have something character driven about it. It had to have some sort of shift that occurs in it that's about something beyond, oh, they're making love now, you know? And so that moment for him is really, it's an anxiety attack, it's a panic attack. It's that sort of moment where the wound is exposed. And of course, in that level of vulnerability and intimacy and with the person he's missed the most, you know, in an intimate moment with her, those walls finally break and then you see the wound. And that's when she finally sees him and understands, oh my God, he has a wound that he can't articulate. And that's my job, is to help him get past this. So I can't remember the question, but idea was, so yeah, journeying them into places that they've never been and into, you know, listen, Rick and Michonne, especially Rick, doesn't talk a ton. So yeah, writing a lot for them to say, I had to cut it probably about 10 minutes out of it, which was all painful, but you know, necessary. And so there's a lot more talking that we were doing. We had 20 minute takes of their scene after lovemaking, and they just shoot it in one take and then shoot it from another angle in one take. So it was a lot of talking, but it was justifying the journey they have to take to the breakthrough. It can't come easy and it can't come quickly. It has to be journeyed to. So that was all the navigation. How far do you stretch them and let them be themselves at the same time?
And then you add a little dose of brevity in it with the Roomba at the end of the scene.
Yes, the Roomba fighting the good fight to the end.
Television, though, is notorious for lack of time to rehearse. And it sounds like if you're doing 20-minute takes, a conversational scene, you can't just do that without rehearsal time. What were you able to allot for preparation, you and Andy? And was it close to what you ideally would have had?
Yeah, we did. I mean, thankfully, you know, I don't know. This might sound, you know, whatever. But, you know, we're both from theater, so we like to rehearse. So we would find our own time to, you know, we'd rehearse on our days off. We would get on a Zoom because he was in Jersey and I'd rushed back to Brooklyn every weekend. You know, we'd get on a Zoom and we would just go over it and keep working on it. And you know, in between takes of whatever the episode before that we were shooting, or, you know, at end of the day, wherever, we would just sneak time and work through it and keep working on it together. And yeah, we understood it had to, because it has to build. Like someone asked me if there's improv in, like, if we improvised lines. I was like, no, we did not improvise any lines. We couldn't. Like, it had to ratchet to a place. And that doesn't allow for improvisation. It has to be, you learn the dance and then you forget the dance so that you're in, you know, you can just flow, you know? So that was definitely, we had to just find the time to make sure, because we both wanted to be able to live in it freely without any constraints.
So one thing that surprised me about episode 4, in addition to what happened on screen, it was just such a beautiful episode from top to bottom, but you're starring in this, you co-created this, you executive produced this, you wrote this, but you didn't direct this one. I was kind of surprised by that. Is directing something that you would like to do next in your career?
Oh, absolutely. I'm really building towards that. You know, Michael Slovis was, he's fantastic. I mean, listen, there wasn't even a chance in the world that I could get that done, because all the prep that has to go on to get something to direct,
is while I'm shooting, I'm on set shooting episode 3 and 2. He's over there, you know, putting together the episode. So like literally, I don't think it would have been possible. But in terms of, you know, his expertise, you know, he was dealing with an episode that, of course, bottle episodes always get shafted with the budget. So he's dealing with, you know, the time and the money aspects. And he's so brilliant with, he used to be a well-known cinematographer from so long ago, but also well-known specifically from Breaking Bad. And so his ability to work also with how it's shot and how to make sure time and money are met and getting the shots as beautifully as he did at the same time. It was really quite something. And also his ability to deeply respect my vision. You know, as I was saying, I walked him and Sarah through what this story is. I walked everyone else through it later, but it was something to break down that people had to really adjust to understanding, like, what is all this talking? You know what I mean? It's just different for TV. You know, it was different. And so it was a lot of stuff to break down. And he really respected what I put on the page. And he's such a beautiful energy as well. So he was really able to bring cast and crew and everyone together in a really beautiful way. You know, he's just a real, he's a pro, he's a veteran, he's a pro. And so he was the perfect person to help with this, to help get it done. Yeah. So much love to Slovis.
In the writing process, was it sometimes hard for you to remember that there were still zombies out the window, that you still had to have that as a part of the story, even if it was not the thing where your heart necessarily was?
No, I listen. So budget-wise, a lot of my zombies were cut. So I had zombies galore, man. I liked playing with them, actually, because they just present a great punctuation sometimes from a writer's perspective. They punctuate moments, they break through things where you're like, you don't want them to. You know what I mean? They're actually great to play with. And I never, you know, I've never written something with zombies in it. So I actually did not mind it at all. But there was that time where the structure of the episode is designed to give these characters a reprieve from the sense of constant urgency. You know, and that's something I remember explaining very specifically to the network, that this is not an urgency, urgency, urgency episode. This is an episode where there's a reprieve time that they have to find in here in order to execute story and not cut to, cut to, cut to, cut to, you know? And I think because of my sensibilities from theater, I'm like, okay, but I see all the cuts and all the move, 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 action, action, but let me have some story. Let me have some character time here. Let me see something land on somebody and see how they process that into a response, you know, like, so that's something I pushed for, just allowing it, the structure, to have that reprieve time and justifying it in the sense of what part of the building they were in and the type of place they end up, the sort of cocoon that's sort of designed for them to come out, hopefully butterflies, and then it destructs when they're done with it. But it was important that there was a living character sort of aspect to the actual environment. And it wasn't just about cutting around and running and jumping, but it had to be about stories, characters. Otherwise, if it's not in this episode, where?
Absolutely. Obviously, you know, there's 2 episodes left in The Ones Who Live. We don't know how Michonne's story ends, if this is indeed an end for the character, but would you be interested in some sort of like a Walking Dead endgame of sorts in which all of the spinoffs kind of are reunited and back into the same world to maybe bring a close to the franchise? Or do you still feel like you have unfinished business with some of the other characters in this universe?
I will say, Leslie, one of those questions I cannot answer much more. I will say this. I will say anything's possible. That's what I'll say. Anything's possible. We definitely poured all we had into trying to make this a very fulfilling experience for people, because we know people waited for it for a long time to happen. We promised it a while ago. So getting it to this point was a labor of love.
Yeah.
So, you know, we hope people continue to enjoy them.
Having written and showrun episode 4, are you taking on any kind of similar roles for the Disney Plus Wakanda series? And does having this experience with Michonne and having this creative control with this character translate to how you hope to approach Okoye in the Marvel world moving forward, as in writing in addition to acting?
We'll have to see. We'll have to see how all that occurs. What I love about both these characters is that they've had a lot of story in them, and they're really, really, I'm just thankful. Like, I didn't create them. They were roles I received, and I'm just thankful for them, because there's just a lot of story that they both have in them and dimension, and, you know, I adore them both. So we'll have to see, Leslie. You'll be the first to know.
I'm going to hold you to that. Did your time with Marvel at all inform how you approached The Walking Dead in terms of any of the direct lessons that you learned from working in an MCU property? Like, how did kind of stepping away from Walking Dead, going to Marvel, and then coming back really affect what you brought back into Michonne?
It's an interesting question. I'm not sure if, I mean, I feel like they're such specific things of themselves, you know, they are very specifically different entities. And, you know, one thing I feel like Michonne has always done is sort of, not always, well, I'd say, let's say from season 5 onwards, is make me like go, oh, dang, I could learn from this chick. Like, there's something very mature about her as she's gone on. And I'm like, oh, man, I want to be more of a woman because of this chick. You know, like, there's just something she teaches me, quite honestly. And I don't know if I feel Okoye is just different. I feel like Okoye almost has things she needs to learn. You know what I mean? Like, there are things that Okoye, so they're, I just think they're very different women. And so in terms of the journey of doing them both, it's just been a real blessing. Or in terms of Marvel versus Walking Dead, I don't know. They're very different entities. And of course, television film, which is just a very different type of approach, you know, but it's just been amazing in terms of the family you navigate, you create in both places.
Yeah.
And how that really is at the crux of enjoying what you do. It really is the people around you. And thank God I've been really blessed by that in both places.
Is there any talks of you taking on the Black Panther mantle in the future?
Leslie, you're hilarious. I will say I have not heard of these talks, but who knows what talks occur when one is not there. But I have never heard of such a talk, Leslie.
I had to ask.
So one of the scheduling casualties from the pandemic was your adaptation of Americana, which was supposed to be your first stint as showrunner. And I sort of have two questions there. The first is, I loved the book, and I was curious if you still have any hope that it might get resurrected at some point.
Not that I know of, but the beauty, I think, of it all is the thing I was just saying, which is the aspects of family that can grow. Because the women that I worked with there, I'm still like creating something new with, creating something with, and they're just incredible human beings that I got to connect with. And that is really the journey of trying to tell story outside of, you know, what we've seen is something that I feel like the family that's been created is something that I'm so thankful for. And yeah, I'm excited to talk more about those things when I can.
Well, probably following up on that, that was such a unique experience given what was happening in the world. But what were you able to learn from that truncated experience in terms of getting perspective on the business from the other side of the camera?
Oh, God. I mean, like, the journey has been like, there's so many, because I've been in, long after that, I've been developing television and, you know, have a few couple things in development. And so that and so many things that have come after it, really, I've learned a lot about the other side, because, you know, I've been working with ABC Signature and like I've been developing things with a few networks. So like the learning I've done since I left the show of Walking Dead has been profoundly something. And you learn a lot. I mean, even, and I think the beauty is I was able to see it sort of as I was working on this show and being an executive producer and co-creator and working very closely with Gimple. Gimple sometimes would say, listen, there are 3 showrunners. It's not just me, you know? And so that aspect of all that, I realized as I was doing this, I was like, oh, all these things I've learned over these last 4 years, I was able to really see those tools come into play as I was handling The Ones Who Live, which, you know, the understanding of how networks function, the understanding of budget and the understanding of being very particular about the team around you and how you guys communicate. And there's so many things that you learn as you go through, and also like script creation and journeying and all that stuff. There's so much story, like how you make sure. And also the things I learned from Walking Dead that helped me with The Ones Who Live. Because I'm like, okay, there are things that happened in The Walking Dead. I wasn't in the editing room. I'm in the editing room now. So I'm going to make sure that these things don't happen now because I saw them happen there. So there was just so many things that I feel like I'm in a season of really being like, oh my God, I'm thankful for all of it. Because I see how you're sharpened into knowing how to move forward, how to navigate the next thing. And that's really what I feel like The Ones Who Live, working with Andy and Gimple and Denise, please let me never forget Denise,
without whom I don't know where. I really don't think The Walking Dead would have made it past season two without Denise Huth. And so we were smart enough to beg her to join us. I've been like, Denise, anything I ever do, woman, you know, don't ever leave me, you know. But having someone like her, you realize the team, and it's a beautiful thing, because you realize more and more you're just getting sharpened, and you're gonna do the next thing, you get sharpened more, and you're gonna keep creating story, and hopefully people will like it.
Oh, I love this interview so much, but sadly we were running short on time, and we do like to wrap these interviews by asking everyone the same question. What have you been watching and enjoying outside of things that you've been working on?
Oh my god, I love Abbott Elementary. I'm a big, big, big Curb Your Enthusiasm fan. And I saw him for the first time, actually, at, where was I? I guess it was Vanity Fair, I don't know. He was just like leaning against a wall, and I was like, I'd be remiss. And he's like, don't be remiss. I was like, I'd be remiss. Don't be remiss. I just had to let him know that I see him in myself, and it's very frightening, and yet it's fun, and I, you know, I love his show. But I'm sad it's ending. It's very bizarre how much I've do see myself, see Larry David in myself, but it's true. And, you know, I'm sad it's ending. So that's definitely been a key thing I've been watching. And I've been watching some, it's like a documentary on, it's on Netflix. It's on World War II. No, it's not on World War II. It's on the conflict between Russia and the United States. And it starts when they were allies in World War II. And yeah, I've just really, yeah, don't ask me. Sometimes I'm nerdish that way, but that's where I've been tucked away lately. Yeah. I'm around McCarthyism right now.
Well, Danai, thank you so much for being so generous with your time, and congratulations on everything to do with The Walking Dead and The Ones Who Live.
Thank you, Leslie. Thanks for sticking it out with us all these years. We appreciate it.
The Walking Dead, The Ones Who Live airs Sundays at 9 p.m. on AMC and AMC Plus.
As usual, we wrap things up with the Critics Corner.
Number three.
Lots to choose from this week, Dan. You've got easily one of the most anticipated shows of the year with The Three-Body Problem for Netflix from the creators of Game of Thrones. Apple's star-studded Palm Royale. You've got X-Men 97, The Return of the Animated Series. Homicide New York for Disney+. And probably the funniest show title I've heard in a long time that's not Untamed, Chicken Nugget, also on Netflix. Dan, what do you got?
Well, okay, so we didn't talk last week, and so I didn't get to tell people that I really like Apple TV Plus's Manhunt, incidentally, if anyone cares. I know that it got mixed reviews. Our Angie Hahn really liked it, and I was in the same camp as Angie, but I also was having dinner on Sunday night with a couple people who loved the book and didn't in any way like the way that the TV series was handling the story. So I don't know if that necessarily means if you read the book, avoid the series. This happens to be one of those instances in which I didn't actually read the book, as regular listeners will know, and as will be established when I compare Three-Body Problem to the book there. I tend to try to read the book. That case, I didn't, and I thought it was actually a fairly gripping and fairly substantive exploration of both the Lincoln assassination, the search for John Wilkes Booth, but even more than that, an exploration of how Lincoln's death impacted Reconstruction, presidency of Andrew Johnson, played wonderfully by Glenn Morshower, Landry's dad from Friday Night Lights. So I really like that show, and some people don't, but I think Tobias Menzies is great. I think a lot of the cast is really superior, and it's only 7 episodes, and, you know, felt like it moved pretty well. You mentioned Chicken Nugget, and Chicken Nugget premiered last week. I wouldn't have been able to say anything about it, because as much as I begged Netflix for screeners for Chicken Nugget, Netflix was not sending out screeners for Chicken Nugget. The strange thing is that Chicken Nugget is a good show, and it's like a good show on an empirical level, I think. I don't think it's a good show on a, well, it's the best show I've ever seen about a woman who steps into a mysterious purple container and somehow becomes a chicken nugget, and leaving her father and the man who loves her to attempt to denuggetize her. And while it is the best show I've ever watched with that particular plot, it's just a good show. It's a fairly smart, fairly savvy comedy. It has a lot of very outlandish visual ideas. It has a lot of performances that are broad, but also amusing physical comedy performances. It's a show that extends its premise, which seems like a fairly thin premise, I will acknowledge that, extends it fairly well. I haven't finished it yet because there's really entirely too much darn TV. Like, I mean, more than usual. This week and next week are out of control. Next week in particular is bonkers. So I've only watched 5 episodes, and I will admit the more answers that the show is giving, the less interested I am. And that is very much the reality of any show, I would have to say, about a young woman in the suburbs of Seoul who becomes a chicken nugget. I would have to say it's one of those premises where the more details you give, probably it begins to strain credulity. I mean, right up until that point, it's a fairly grounded premise, but then you start giving answers and, you know, not so much. So it's entirely possible I could find myself in the last 5 episodes being like, yeah, I wasn't as amused by this as I thought I was. But yeah, I find it amusing and likable. And I wish that Netflix had sent out screeners, because I would have happily written a review telling people that Chicken Nugget was an amusing show to watch. Whereas it appears, based on the regular weekly top tens, that basically Netflix users are watching The Gentlemen. That's the thing that they're watching. Gentlemen's been number one on Netflix for 3 weeks, 4 weeks straight, pretty much every single day, which probably makes it a hit. Or alternatively, they'll cancel it next week and it'll be like Brother's Son all over again. The thing I have to say is I mentioned The Gentlemen on the podcast 2 or 3 weeks ago. I'd only watched 2 episodes, and one of the things I said was that I was very, very familiar with the idea of liking the first 10 or 15 minutes of a Guy Ritchie movie and then getting sick of it, and I thought it was distinctly possible that that would be the case also with The Gentlemen. I watched all 8 episodes of that one, and I did not tire of it. I would say probably that my enthusiasm based on the first 2 episodes was a little bit more than by the very end, but I thought it was just really a generally entertaining show, start to mostly finish. And I assume, again, based on the 3 straight weeks almost entirely at number one, that it's a success for Netflix and that there will be a second season, because certainly such things are possible based on where the show ended. To me, it feels as if it is a good show and a show that people would like. And so anyway, but I don't need to tell people to like it because apparently it's been very successful. Anyway, so let's get to newer things. We can talk quickly about Homicide New York, which is Dick Wolf coming to Netflix in unscripted form, but basically doing his New York Law and Order thing. Basically, it's a bunch of cases that have had plot lines ripped from the headlines in fictionalized form on various Law and Order shows, only this is the real version, and lots of the real cops involved and the real lawyers involved and the family members of victims and stuff of that nature. And it's very well sourced. I think that is probably what it is best at. It is completely and totally a commercial for the NYPD. It is nothing other than that. At the end of the day, it is like, boy, here's a bunch of awesome NYPD detectives, and here's how they brilliantly watch video footage, and here's how they brilliantly interrogate suspects and all of that, and here's how they get their man. So if you aren't necessarily in the mood for that, yeah, it could be tiring. But if, however, you have an insatiable desire for all things Law and Order, this will fill that gap. In terms of shows about people who are simply good at their jobs, I much preferred Disney Plus's Photographer, which is from the people behind Free Solo, and it's basically a bunch of little hour-long capsule portraits of famous nature photographers and war photographers in general. And the way that they do their jobs and all of that, it's really, really solid. It's that one I like quite a bit. So let's get to some of this week's bigger releases, and we are moving slowly towards the biggest of them, X-Men 97. I'll be honest on this one. Generationally speaking, X-Men 97, the X-Men animated series from the 90s is more in the millennial wheelhouse than the Gen X wheelhouse. Leslie, do you have particular emotional ties to X-Men 97, to the X-Men animated franchise?
I just remember watching it on Saturday mornings and loving it.
Okay,
and
but you actually
X-Men
did.
Fan or superhero fan growing up.
Okay, well, have you watched the new episodes?
Not yet. I've been obsessed with Young Royals instead this week.
Okay, why have you not been obsessed with Chicken Nugget instead?
Because I'm waiting for my wife to come back from a trip to visit friend of the five, Chris Hayner.
Okay, well, I'm glad you're saving Chicken Nugget for that. That is very important. Okay, so
I've been getting up at 3 a.m. to watch baseball like an idiot.
Thank heavens. Thank heavens that's done. Such a strange thing. So like they have this little dinky series in South Korea and now everyone's going to go back and play more spring training games. It's a strange system. Okay, so again, X-Men 97. It does probably require a certain amount of nostalgia that I don't have quite as much. Definitely I watched the X-Men animated show and, you know, I'm not immune to the nostalgia, particularly of the theme song. You play the theme song for me, I get the requisite shivers and all of that. And the new version is very much enamored with the old version and trying to give people comparable things. And what I'll say is, I thought I was maybe just going to sample it and check out. And after the first episode, I was kind of tepid. And then I liked the next two episodes significantly more. And so what I will say about this is that you do not need deep nostalgia for the X-Men animated series to enjoy X-Men 97. I think it probably helps because you know the storytelling tone, you know the voices, you know all of the things that it's paying homage to, but it is not required. If you just like the X-Men gimmick and storytelling as well as its subtext, the most hilarious things on social media are people saying that X-Men has gone woke. I mean, invariably, almost anyone who uses the word woke at this point is comical, but anyway, yes. So it's totally woke, but so is the X-Men franchise. So whatever. Okay, so let's get to the week's three big shows, except that chances are pretty good that most listeners haven't heard of Diarra from Detroit at all. And I'm going to say that if I were going on a pure star-based system for the next three shows that I'm about to review, the one that I would give the most stars to is probably BET Plus's Diarra from Detroit. Is it necessarily the best of the three shows? I'm not necessarily sure. But is it the show that, to my mind, of these three shows, achieves closest to what it is trying to achieve? I would say probably it is. And so let's just pretend that you fully and totally have Palm Royale and Three Body Problem on your radar and you don't have Diarra from Detroit. Here's me doing my critical service and telling you that Diarra from Detroit is a really fun and fairly distinctive piece of genre bending. It is more than anything else, it is a calling card explosion on the scene for creator star Diarra Kilpatrick, who has been in some things, but this is her show. She created it, she stars in it, and it says basically, here is someone you are going to want to follow. So that is the biggest of the bottom lines on Diarra from Detroit, is Diarra Kilpatrick is a talent to watch and folks should watch it. Now, as for Diarra from Detroit, it's an entertaining show. It's the premise is sort of all over the place. Diarra Kilpatrick plays a woman named Diarra from Detroit. It's right there in the title. And she is a school teacher who is in the middle of a divorce from a character played by Morris Chestnut, who is only a guest star, but is amusing. I believe as with all great Morris Chestnut roles, basically all that matters about his character is that he's extremely handsome. Who's going to dispute that? Anyway, though, Diarra, this being the character, not the creator, is trying to move past her divorce, and she has a one-night stand, and that one-night stand leads her into a strange mystery tied to a multi-decade-old missing person case that takes her around Detroit, through Detroit. Sometimes the show is very funny. It is often very dark. There's violence. There are threats of violence. It is not a straightforward comedy, nor is it a straightforward gumshoe type show. It is yet another missing persons mystery. So lots of familiar, lots of missing persons, and lots of detectives who aren't really detectives. So that is what the character is. And it has its own voice, and it has its own sense of humor, and it made me snort laugh a handful of times. I'm invested loosely in the characters already. The supporting or guest cast is really, really good. Harry Lennox, already mentioned Morris Chestnut. If you stick around to the third episode, Felicia Rashad has a really great, really messy supporting performance. I feel as if Felicia Rashad does not usually get to act in the way that she does in the third episode of Diarra from Detroit. So big ups to Felicia Rashad, and really and truly, Diarra from Detroit, it's another very solid show from BET+. They also had a real low-key winner in Average Joe with Dion Cole. I reviewed that one. Angie reviewed Diarra from Detroit and gave it a positive review also. They just seem to be doing pretty solid work on BET+, without people necessarily knowing where or what BET+ is. So once again, this is just service journalism right here, service criticism, which is to tell you that there's good stuff on BET+, and you might enjoy it if you have it or might enjoy it. So it would be, to me, this feels like the kind of thing that ideally should be getting pushed out onto other platforms as well, just to give it added visibility. Paramount Plus being the obvious answer for where it could go, where it might get a few more eyeballs. But the truth is, Diarra from Detroit, BET+, they're doing pretty solid work. And again, Diarra Fitzpatrick is, she's just really good, and she's really talented. And if this doesn't blow her up, I would want to be standing in line if I were other streamers and networks trying to figure out what her next thing was. But I think this will probably be fairly successful. But who the bleep would ever know what successful was on BET+, other than, I mean, honestly, whether it pops up on the radar of white television critics, honestly, which is not which is not the standard by which they value success. So, but I also don't think they mind me telling people it's a good show. Palm Royale, unfortunately, is not. Unfortunately, Palm Royale is irritating. That's about what I would say about Palm Royale. It is irritating. I made it through 5 episodes. I really could have just stopped at 1. It is largely a sensibility thing. Let's be perfectly clear. If it is your sensibility, you will love this show. It is kind of, it's in the tonal range of Desperate Housewives and that sort of catty comic soap opera. That's kind of the best case version, or a best case version of it, which means absolutely every performance is dialed up to 11 or 12. There is not a subtle moment in the entire show. On the other hand, and I cannot dispute this, it's such a remarkable cast that you kind of want to keep going with it because this is what's going to be occupying the people in the cast for at least the brief foreseeable future. So if you don't want to abandon some of these people into the sands of time, you have to watch Palm Royale. But the truth is, if you watch the first episode, and these are all hour-long episodes with this particular tone, so if you don't like the tone, the fact that you have to spend an hour at a time with these characters and these voices, just check out. It doesn't get better. It doesn't get worse in the 5 episodes I've seen. So again, what is Palm Royale? Kristen Wiig plays Maxine Simmons. She arrives in Palm Beach and tries to inject herself into high society. She faces lots of resistance from the pool club that she is trying to become a member of, and some of the more, I don't know, snooty people in that club include characters played by Allison Janney and Leslie Bibb and several other people you will recognize. There are a bunch of vintage sitcom stars, including Julia Duffy, Mindy Cohn, a lot of people where you go, oh, I remember that person. Ricky Martin plays the bartender at the club. I don't know that Ricky Martin is in the same, I remember that person, but, you know, he's Ricky Martin. And then you sort of expand the parameters. You have Laura Dern, who was probably the part of the show that I liked the most. No, that's not true at all, because the best part of the show really is Carol Burnett, who has a key supporting role, which is just a reminder of two things. One, that Carol Burnett is a national treasure, and two, that Carol Burnett is still a national treasure. Which is to say, you put Carol Burnett in something now, and you are not doing stunt casting with Carol Burnett. You are getting Carol freaking Burnett doing Carol freaking Burnett things. So, total credit for Carol Burnett doing Carol Burnett things. If the show were just Carol Burnett doing Carol Burnett things, I would probably like it very much. It's just a lot of very arch tone, a lot of cattiness, a lot of the things that are supposed to be happening in the background to give it context and give it substance, sort of feminism, because it's a period show. It's early 70s, so it's lots of talk of early feminism, lots of talk of the Nixon campaign, stuff like that. It, to me, it's all fairly meaningless. It's all name-checking. And no, really, I did not enjoy this show at all. I found this show largely tonally unpleasant, but the cast of it was good enough that I was willing to follow along for a certain period of time. But I also hit the fifth episode and I was like, okay, I think I'm probably just done with this. So really and truly, though, if you watch the first 30 minutes and you aren't into it, I promise you, you will not become into it. What I can also promise you is there is more Carol Burnett than it appears that there is from the beginning. So if that's a thing to keep you watching, so be it. And last but not least, definitely not least, because Palm Royale was least. So definitely Three Body Problem, not least, is Netflix's adaptation of Liu Cixin's, and I totally brutalized that, my apology to everyone in the entire nation of China, however many billion people that is right now, novel, which is titled The Three Body Problem. And the novel has a V and it has three spelled out and it has a hyphen, and the TV show is the number three and no hyphen. It's all very confusing. Anyway, it was adapted by the Game of Thrones duo David Benioff and D.B. Weiss, along with Alexander Wu, whose writing people will know from the second season of The Terror and from True Blood and from a bunch of other stuff, actually. Under normal circumstances, Alexander Wu's name would be easily the top name that people list. And instead, some people are just going with, it's the new show from the Game of Thrones guys. That is not really what the case is. Give Alexander Wu his respect. So Three Body Problem, it's a little bit complicated to say what it is. It's complicated to describe the book. I've talked about it on the podcast before, how like the first 90 pages are all about China's cultural revolution. And a lot of the things that are the premise of the book and then the show, they really don't kick in for a pretty reasonable amount of time. What I can say is that there is a threat to humanity coming at some point in the future, a little bit like Foundation. It's one of those stories where the undercurrent or the spine is this very human moral dilemma of how do you get people to care about a catastrophe that is going to come well outside of their lifespan? It's how do you get people to mitigate a tragedy that will affect their great, 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 great grandchildren and not them? And can you associate that theme with global warming? Of course you can. One of the things in both the book and the TV show is that one of the main characters is given a copy of Rachel Carson's Silent Spring in one of the very, very first scenes. So the environmental message is absolutely a thing. But there's more, and stuff is coming from outer space, et cetera, et cetera. The book is very convoluted and very wonky in its use of physics, in the way that it kind of approaches its characters and their main dilemma. It is a book that is sometimes much more conceptually interesting than it is gripping or fast moving. And that's part of what makes it distinctive, though. And so you watch the show, and if you've read the book, you will see that the creators are very conscious in their desire to touch on the things that make the book interesting. At the same time, they are not able to give depth to a lot of the things. So it's a lot of name checking. It's a lot of superficial versions of complicated concepts. It's a lot of pointing to things that are notable from the book, but not necessarily being able to do them fully. At the same time, sometimes what they are able to do is still more than I might have guessed they were able to do. And some of the things that the show visualizes are impressive. Sometimes it looks as if it's a show with a certain amount of epic scope and reach. Other times it really feels like people sitting around a room talking, and it doesn't feel big at all. The rhythm of the show isn't exactly right. It reaches its climax probably in the sixth episode, maybe the fifth episode, around the time that basically they finish the plot of the first book. And there's a big, big action set piece, which makes no sense logically, but is still big. And then the show kind of goes on for a few more episodes and then wraps up its first season. Some of the characters are very thin. Part of why some of the characters are thin is because one character from the book, one of the primary characters, has been split into not one, not two, not three, not four, but five different characters. And also those five characters allow the show to have a number of Western actors in it. And so thus it can reach a larger audience. The cast is good, but largely underutilized. I would say that Liam Cunningham from Game of Thrones and Benedict Wong from lots of things are probably the two best parts of the show. They're sort of grizzled and trying to save humanity in their own way. And then you have the young, more familiar actors. You have Isaac Gonzalez, Jovan Adepo, John Bradley, also from Game of Thrones, Alex Sharp, Jess Hong. And those are the last five of the five characters who were pulled from one character. And the performances are all okay, but they feel like exactly that. They feel like one totally rounded character is split into five somewhat one-dimensional characters. A little bit frustrating. Some of the supporting cast is good. Some of it is underused. Jonathan Pryce is there. He serves zero purpose. It is pointless. Marlo Kelly, who was one of my favorites from the short-lived one-and-done series Dare Me, a show that I really liked. I thought she was great in it. I thought she was going to get lots of big roles out of it. Mostly she hasn't, but here she is. She plays a woman who's part of a sort of a cult that's tied to whatever's coming in society. She's good. She's lots of fun. So I was interested by the show, and I was at times impressed, and at times it's sort of flat and methodical. And look, you look at the reviews and the reviews are kind of all over the place. So check it out. I really can't tell if this is one that's better or worse if you've read the book. I think that there are lots of things that happen on the show that if you haven't read the book, they will make no sense to you whatsoever. But not like in a, I'm confused by what's happening, more in a, okay, that was a thing. I don't understand why it was important, but okay, onward. And then the people who have read the book can be all snobby and say, oh, well, in the book, this is what that was supposed to be. And I feel like there are probably like a half dozen things like that where there are things that are there and things that people who haven't read the book will probably be able to guess. Oh, I'm sure that was cool on the page. And in some cases, they probably were. So that's a lot of that's a lot of TV. Let's do the quick recap of it. Netflix's Chicken Nugget. It's a hoot. And the premise woman turns into a chicken nugget, having stepped into a mysterious purple machine. It sounds ridiculous. The series is ridiculous, but it's ridiculous done well. So for heaven's sakes, check out Chicken Nugget on Netflix. If you're a big fan of the NYPD Blue and you think that they don't get the press they deserve, Homicide NY is also on Netflix. It's definitely rah, rah, rah NYPD. So if you feel like that. I liked Netflix 97, not Netflix, I liked X-Men 97 on Disney Plus. Some. I will probably watch more episodes of it, but I also feel no nostalgia for it. It feels like some people are genuinely champing at the bit for this show because it's their childhood and their identity. I feel like those people probably might love it. I did not love it, but there you go. DR from Detroit is just really good. It's really good. It introduces a new voice who some people will not know. It is on BET Plus, so lots of people will not have access to it. So that is simply the reality of what it is. But if you do, good show. Palm Royale annoyed the shit out of me. Maybe it won't annoy the shit out of you. Watch an episode. If you enjoy it, if you laugh, and I do know people who have laughed a lot at this show, there you go. Enjoy. But if you don't, I promise you, that's what the show is. So move on with your life. And Three Body Problem, probably more workmanlike than inspired, but still workmanlike in this context, has virtues to it. So some things good, some things a little dull, some things a little flat, but it's got stuff about it. So that's Netflix. It's all there. And that was indeed a long Critics Corner. And as I've already warned you, next week, even more.
Speaking of more, you can subscribe to the Hollywood Reporter's Now See This for more of Dan's weekly recommendations. You can also bookmark thr.com/TV-reviews for comprehensive coverage. That feels like a good place to wrap things up. Thank you, as always, for listening to TV's Top 5, the Hollywood Reporter's TV podcast.
Subscribe to us on all of your various podcasting platforms. If you like us, rate us. If you really like us, write a little reviewy thing. They help spread the word of mouth. Come say hi to us on the social medias. She is, as always, at Snoodit with two O's. I am, as always, at The Fine Print, F-I-E-N. Let us know what's working, what isn't working, how angry you are at us for not having a podcast last week. It's what we're here for. If, however, you have questions for future mailbag segments, and maybe next week, maybe the week after, who knows, email us at tvstop5@thr.com. That is tvstop5, the numeral 5, at thr.com. Until next week, Leslie.
Until next week, Dan.